I don't know if you saw that Gallup survey in February.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that Americans are literally at an all-time low in their future outlook.
Yes.
In more than 20 years. This is the lowest it's been. And I think a lot of people stop and just say, like, well, that makes sense. But what are we going to do about it? Mm-hmm. Because you can't make a forward movement from that place of collective negative outlook. And I think it right now, like, so many people are living in uncertainty. There's heaviness and uncertainty. We cannot make sense of most of the things personally and globally that are occurring. And the brain, when the brain is full of uncertainty, it is in threat mode. The amygdala is firing up. It is in threat response mode. And when you are in that mode, your brain does something out of protection. It's not because there's anything wrong with you. Out of protection, it starts filling in the gaps, and it fills in the gaps with the worst case scenarios.
I'm Jon Favreau, and you just heard from Dr. Deepika Chopra, a clinical psychologist known as the Optimism Doctor. We spend most of our time here talking about awful and raging news, both life in the Trump era and particularly on this show, the way that information hits us every second of every day through our phones and our feeds. And all that makes maintaining a sense of optimism really, really tough. I know that's true for myself. And it's probably one of the most frequent things we hear from all of you who listen to Crooked Shows. Of course, a sense of optimism is important, even necessary in this line of work, because otherwise, what's the point? Why fight for a better future if we don't believe one is possible? Why organize? Why vote if we don't believe that work will yield something better for us, for our children, for our grandchildren? We actually need to be able to process the news and the world for all of its awfulness while still figuring out how we might be able to change it. All of that is why today I wanted to talk to an expert in optimism, someone who can remind us of how we can find optimism again when it feels out of reach. In fact, Dr. Chopra actually has an unusual perspective on optimism, believing that it's not really just a mindset, but a learnable set of skills that even the most pessimistic among us can learn to apply. I invited her on to talk about those skills, as well as why she believes optimism rather than cynicism is the most logical reaction to this current political moment. It was a great conversation and one that I'm very thankful to have had. And before we start, as always, please consider subscribing to Friends of the Pod if you haven't already so that you don't miss out on anything. Friend of the Pod subscribers get our new extra episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends, other subscriber-only shows like Polar Coaster with Dan Pfeiffer, access to all of our excellent Substack newsletters like Pod Save America Open Tabs, ad-free episodes of all your favorite Crooked Pods, and you get to feel good about supporting one of the few pro-democracy independent media outlets left in Trump's America. So head to crooked.com/friends and subscribe today. All right, let's get into it. Here's Dr. Deepika Chopra. Deepika, welcome.
Hi, nice to see you.
It's nice to see you too. For people who don't know, we know each other.
We do know each other.
Our sons are besties.
Yes.
Have become besties in school.
So cute.
They also play t-ball together.
That is
coached
really
by our spouses.
Our spouses. We were just talking about we are the little league wags.
We
you
are.
And I.
Yeah, we just go to the games as fans and support.
I kind of
Emily
help.
And Alex.
I help a little bit.
You do help. Yeah, I
Emily
I chase
calls
our toddler
me.
Around.
I'm the dugout girl. You're
Congrats on the book.
Thank you.
You've written a wonderful book.
Thank you.
And so we've known each other for a little while. I'll be honest. The first time I heard that you're known as the Optimism Doctor, my reaction was, what kind of LA bullshit is this?
Yep. I hope there were some eye rolls.
Some eye rolls. And now, of course, I very much understand it. Your doctorate is in clinical health mm-hmm. psychology. Your dissertation was literally on optimism mm-hmm. and visualization. Mm-hmm. You had a postdoctoral fellowship at UCLA and Cedars. Mm-hmm. But maybe you could start talking about like how you got into this line mm-hmm. of work.
Not linearly, let me tell you that. My first, I didn't even major an undergrad in psychology. Hmm. And to be honest, I felt like psychology always interested me, but it felt like something that was off the table for me. Hmm. I'm a really sensitive human being, and I was even more so as a teenager. I mean, I talk about it in the book, but when the Titanic came out, the movie, I did not go to school for 2 weeks. So psychology was not something my family nor myself was pushing me into. Uh-huh. But I've always just been very drawn to humans and storytelling and emotions and just being a listener. And I love humans and human storytelling. And so I think I was always curious about that. And I, at the same time, had other ideas and passions. I started my first, like, very first job. I worked while I was in college at a punk music label, which was the best time of my life.
That sounds fun.
And then I went into investment banking for a quick year. A very quick year.
And that was all.
And that was all. And then I worked in the public health sector, and it was kind of, it sort of made sense to me. I was doing a lot of M&A, and the deal-making part was like what sort of lit me up, which again is a very psychological, like people-oriented part of the work. I always had really amazing mentorship and people that were willing to like literally set me aside and say, I saw you light up during this. Have you ever thought of this? My boss at the time was like, they brought in an organizational psychologist. And he was like, I saw you light up in a way I've never seen you light up. Have you thought about, he thought, organizational psychology. I was like, well, that something about that piqued my interest. And I went back to UCLA where I did my undergrad, and I knocked on every single door at UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute and just begged for someone to let me work for free to see what this was all about. And so I took a year off after, and I ended up being able to volunteer. And I went back to school and got my prerequisites because I didn't even have prerequisites. And then I applied to grad school. I remember there was like a big aha moment for me. I always loved the science part and like the data. And I love the brain. I just became really into the brain. And I know that sounds creepy.
It's, you know, fascinating. A lot of it is unknown.
Yes. I think I just followed my curiosity. And I saw one bit of research that just changed and unlocked everything for me. And what it said was, is that the brain is an anticipatory organ. So the brain is constantly sort of working and acting in future tense. It's like, it could be a few moments from now or 6 months from now. And it could be like, I'm looking at this cup of water and my brain tells me it is a cup of water faster than the visual cortex actually registers it as a cup of water.
Right.
Or when you think about eating something, whatever it is, like I'm imagining what I might have for lunch right now, my brain already releases the right amount of insulin to break down that food before we even eat it. And so the brain is just constantly in this future-oriented work mode. And I started to think at the same time, you know, this was many years ago now, but most of the interventions that we were taught to work with clients or patients was many times past-driven, and that's fine. That makes sense to understand who you are and why you are the way you are. And then we were just starting to really talk a lot about the present, so cognitive behavioral techniques, which I love. But I didn't see much in the realm of helping people understand what are they expecting? What are they projecting into their future? And what I came to know is that when you think about something, whatever event it is, whether, again, it is a few moments from now, it's later in the day, it's 6 months from now, whatever you are expecting to happen and predicting to happen impacts how you feel, and then how you feel impacts your behavior. So for me, there was
this aha. That's where anxiety comes from,
exactly.
Right? Like anticipatory anxiety
exactly.
is the whole.
Okay. Exactly. And so I felt like, whoa, wait a second here. I'm really passionate about this idea of understanding what people are predicting, even about like small mundane things in their lives, but then taking it a step further and saying, can we actually change that? And so that became my passion, my niche. In that time, I felt like the things I was curious about and studying were a little too woo-woo for like the science community that I was in and way too sciencey for the self sort of growth community at that time. And so somewhere along the way, I think like a little before COVID, people really sort of caught up with this idea of blending sort of the two and this idea of like optimism and hope theory and just how important that was. The optimism doctor part really came organically. And I remember I was really interested in sort of, I would call my therapy work self-worth work instead of therapy. I would sit in front of a client and be like, okay, the first time I saw them, we're going to be doing things a little bit differently here's what we're going to do, X, Y, and Z. We're going to look at your optimism. I'm going to ask you some questions. We're going to focus on the things you want and your skills and your strengths and what you're predicting and all this stuff. And at the end of like 20 minutes of taking up 20 minutes of time of this client session, he was like, so you're kind of just like my optimism doctor. And I was like, huh.
I guess that's it.
I guess that's it. And so that is where the optimism doctor piece came from.
What does the actual research say about optimism and how it works in the brain? Like, what have you learned? Just to I know this mm-hmm. what the whole book is about, but just as a yeah. summary of the research and the science behind it, like, how does it work and what has sort of surprised you about it?
We have this like idea of what optimism is, and to be honest, it's like all wrong. Mm. And I think most people think that optimism is about being positive. It's about the silver linings. It's about looking at the world through rose-colored glasses and sort of, in my mind, like, I visually see someone like skipping through like a field of poppies, like singing in bliss while like the world's on fire.
Yeah. It's like blind optimism.
Yes. Yeah. And what I and doing this work, I feel like I have heard every single sort of stereotype of what people think an optimist is under the sun. Often very smart people are like, I'm not an optimist. I'm a realist.
Yeah.
And they sort of separate it as in, like, you can't be a realist while being an optimist. And I thought that was so interesting because I also felt that way. And to be honest, I'm known as the optimism doctor, and I am not the most optimistic person. Mm. Even in my, like, microcosm of family, I'm probably the least optimistic naturally person. And I, like, the good news is what I've learned about it is what's a surprise is optimism's not a personality trait. And I think a lot of people think it is. It is a learned psychological skill that can be trained. And I am training myself
to be more.
And I think the other thing is an optimist, actually, a real optimist, as I call it, is so grounded in reality. And like the definition that we use, from this perspective, is someone that is deeply mindful and aware of the roadblocks and the setbacks and the less than ideal situations. But the caveat is they see them as temporary and something that they have the ability to overcome, even if they don't know how or when.
Like, I've always thought about, in the context of politics for sure, the difference between optimism and hope.
Yes.
And I've always thought about it as like optimism is, or if I'm optimistic about the future, it's people being like, I think it's going to get better. But like, we'll see. It's like a predictive.
Yeah.
And hope, to me at least, is more grounded in agency. Mm-hmm. And it's this, like, I can see the challenges, but I have the sort of ability to change the future and change circumstances.
Right.
To a better future. But it sounds like that
is real
what
optimism.
I think about hope is sort of the real optimism.
I see optimism from my world and perspective as much more related to resiliency and curiosity. Than related to positivity. So it's really much more about, you know, understanding and being very grounded in your authentic emotion, whatever that is. And a lot of times that is not feeling great. That might be rage or grief or, you know, worry or anxiety, whatever those are. But at the very same time of sitting in it, it's allowing yourself to be curious about how this might change. And you're not even committing to, I think it's going to be better yet. You may not even get there yet, but just being able to know, number one, that it will change, because a lot of this is what we call explanatory style and understanding that everything is temporary. And that's a huge hallmark of being able to increase your real optimism factor. You don't have to be someone that knows with certainty that it will be better. You just have to have curiosity that I wonder how this will change. And even from that, which I kind of call being in, it's almost like neutral plus. It's like when you go and order a steak and you're like, I'll have medium rare plus, which people probably hate you for, but in LA, it's okay. The same kind of thing. Like, we don't have to be, optimism doesn't always feel good. And I think that's another surprising factor, because we cultivate our optimism through persevering through struggle. And so I think people think that we really, you know, can only be optimistic when we are blissful and feel good.
Well, you open the book with a very personal story about this. And, you know, this was before we really knew you guys, but I knew Dio had been really sick. Your middle son, who's Charlie's friend.
Yes.
And just learning the details from you writing about that period, the diagnosis, the uncertainty, like having to physically hold him down for his medication.
Yeah.
What was, and you mentioned that sort of it was interesting for you as the optimism doctor to realize that the tools you teach other people to use weren't necessarily the ones you were reaching for at first.
Right.
So can you talk about that experience, sort of what that taught you about optimism?
Yeah. Well, first of all, at the time, it felt like cruel irony. I was literally writing the manuscript for this. And like many, many horrible things that happen, they surprise you and they come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we were told that this medical diagnosis that literally came out of nowhere. I mean, one moment he was, you know, wrestling with his older brother and asking for snacks and wanting to, you know, play with trucks and watch Lightning McQueen over and over and over, to having this earth-shattering, you know, diagnosis that now is setting us off on a path that felt like, you know, a huge mountain that was a long mountain, a year and a half of treatment. It just, what it came out of nowhere, and it was chalked to, as they said, bad luck. It was like 2 in a million chance for a kid to get this. And this rare child, you know, medical diagnosis is definitely not getting the research or funding that it's going to be needing. And so I think aside from just not knowing why it happened, which is a very scary place to be in as a parent, but also not understanding, even with the treatment, like what it was going to mean for us and what the future holds. Mm. And so I remember calling my agent and I was just like, I don't think I can write this. How can I write this? I literally am the most hopeless and helpless I've ever felt in my life. Mm. I'm full of darkness. I feel paralyzed. I'm not writing this book on optimism.
Yeah.
And I kind of retreated to a lot of old habits that I went to when I was like grasping for desperation, just like looking in front of the mirror and being like, my son is healthy. Everything's okay.
And that doesn't necessarily work.
No. And I felt almost like a responsibility that if it didn't work, I wasn't doing it good enough. Mm. And I asked the universe, you know, to, I know it sounds so silly, but, you know, I imagined him being like surrounded by white roses and all these things that I had like read and just like, this is a hologram and you make your own reality. And I just like, you know, looked up to the sky and said, universe, like all I really want is for my son to be healthy, like deliver it. And unfortunately, you know, this was the time when we were waiting the 3 weeks for pathology. And none of that worked for me.
Yeah.
And I remember just sitting underneath my office desk when we were sort of told what the uphill battle we were now up against, our new reality. You know, we had just had the surgery to remove this mass, and now we know what it is. And we have a year and a half ahead of us of treatment, weekly and daily medication, but also weekly. We had to go get another surgery to get a port implanted in his chest. I mean, he's 2 and a half.
Yeah.
And I was just really struggling because I was ruminating over, which I think I'm sure a lot of people can relate, why is this happening to us? Why us? Like, we're good people.
Yeah.
And of all the people, my 2 and a half-year-old son, who's just this like innocent.
He's so sweet.
Sweet. Any kid at 2 and a half, yeah. You can't. And it just, I was so stuck in that. And I was so angry. And I had a major shift at some point, like a few months in. I was very paralyzed by this. I was not doing writing at the time. I was just trying to survive. And, you know, you have to pick yourself up and you have to administer the medication. You have to get him to treatment every Tuesday because who else, like, I'm his mom.
Yeah.
And so we were living this weird reality. And I remember having this shift because I opened back up the manuscript and I was like, okay, I'm just going to read a little bit of what I've been writing.
Mm.
And from cruel irony, I feel like maybe it was divine intervention or something. I don't even know, you know, I'm not necessarily a very religious person, but having to literally write out the tools and be on deadlines for it.
Mm.
And my brain cannot unsee what I am typing and what I'm remembering sharing with a past patient or a client or the research that I'm including. Like I was typing it, so I was processing it, and I was using it. And I remember, like, very distinctly one day writing something for the book and thinking, oh, my gosh, Like, I had this major shift from rumination to agency. And the shift, instead of, why is this happening to us? Because your brain can't go anywhere from there.
Right.
There, like, the prefrontal cortex is not on. You know, it is, you cannot go anywhere from there. And I remember just softening that and thinking, why anyone? Why not us? And that didn't make me feel better, per se. It still really sucked. But it took away some of the anger, and it took away some of the sort of threat response. And immediately after that, I was able to just say, what's my next step? Mm. And the next step was maybe packing the hospital bag, you know, preparing for the next treatment, or, you know, dosing out the medication, or calling insurance companies, or whatever it was. But it sent me more into the mode of agency and, like, what is my next step?
Yeah.
And that was a really big shift for me. It didn't make any of it easier. It was all awful. And I wish I could have learned a lot of what I learned in a different way.
Yeah.
But that is the way I learned it. And I remember just thinking, now at that point, my son, you know, at the end of writing this book, like, I literally wrote the book throughout the entire treatment. And at the end of it, we were approaching the last few treatments. And I said to myself, wow, this should be really a happy time for me. But it actually was the most anxious time, because, again, it was going to be a time where I was not doing anything. At least, like, every Tuesday, which I hated, we were doing something.
Right.
We were going. We were
taking an action.
I had some sense of control. We were doing what we were supposed to do. And I remember thinking, like, wow, this is, I don't want to project this onto my son now. He's 4, and hopefully he's got, you know, a life ahead of him. And every day, if I'm like, is this it? Is that it? Is that, I don't want to project that onto him. It's already hard enough to be a kid growing up in the world.
Well, and interestingly, I mean, we started talking about sort of the brain and how the brain thinks about the future all the time, right?
Yeah.
And we're always very future oriented. And I do think, at least for me, when something bad happens like that, the first instinct, or the way that my brain has worked for a long time, and I'm sort of fixing it, is you're like, you just think about all the bad things
yes.
that could happen. And like,
well, do you know why that happens? It's like the brain, and this is so important for right now, because I think collectively, I don't know if you saw that Gallup survey in February.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that Americans are literally at an all-time low in their future outlook.
Yes.
In more than 20 years. This is the lowest it's been. And I think a lot of people stop and just say, like, well, that makes sense. Like, yes, that makes sense. We can all understand why. There's so many reasons why. But what are we going to do about it? Mm-hmm. Because you can't make a forward movement from that place of collective negative outlook. And I think right now, like, so many people are living in uncertainty. There's heaviness and uncertainty. We cannot make sense of most of the things personally and globally that are occurring. And the brain, when the brain is full of uncertainty, it is in threat mode. The amygdala is firing up. It is in threat response mode. And when you are in that mode, your brain does something out of protection. It's not because there's anything wrong with you. Out of protection, it starts filling in the gaps, and it fills in the gaps with the worst case scenarios.
Yeah. It's funny. I've always been an anxious person, and I think the moment where my personal anxiety about life and what's going to happen and medical stuff or this other thing sort of intersected with what I do professionally was during the pandemic.
Yes.
And I remember, like, a lot of times sitting there at night being like, is this ever going to be normal again? Mm-hmm. Are we going to see our friends again and
right.
our family? Are we going to get sick? What's going to happen when the kids are, you know, when
right.
Charlie's born and we have to do this and now we have it like, and it was just like constantly, and then reading the news
yes.
and like going to all the, and then you're looking through the news because you're looking for the piece of information
right.
in the news that's going to make you feel like, oh, it's fine now.
Right. Or I can do something.
Or I can do something.
And make sense of this.
Right.
And I think the crazy thing about that is they, like, media has really figured out, like, neuroscience.
Yeah.
It really, like, honestly has figured it out perfectly. Like, great job, but not really. Because our brains, like, one of the truths about the brain that I talk about in the book is our brains like to collect evidence to make a thought that we already feel is true more true.
Mm.
That is part of the efficiency.
Confirmation bias.
Confirmation bias.
Yeah.
And I myself have really, like, I This is kind of a silly story, but I only downloaded TikTok like very much late in the game. Like it was only a few years ago.
No, I'm the same way.
And I can do like one thing. Like I'm on Instagram. And even that, like who knows what I'm doing. But we were in Italy, Alex and I. We were like on one of our first like vacations without the kids. And I remember it was the time that Bayesian sank.
Oh, yes. I forgot about that.
Yeah. And of course, I turned on TikTok just then. And I started like watching it because it was sort of in the region that we were in.
Mm-hmm.
And I got like really, it fed me all kinds of things, which obviously I was like interested in. And then all of a sudden it was like, this girl loves conspiracy theories. And it was like all this stuff. And I looked at Alex and I was like, after like hour, like I was just like consuming this stuff. And then I looked, I'm like, what are you watching on TikTok? And his were like this guy walking down the street that would like stop people and play like 10 seconds of a song, and then they would have to guess what the song was. And I'm like, that is so fun. Why can't... So I literally had to actively retrain the algorithm, which, by the way, is so fitting because that is what we have to do with our brains.
Right. Offline is brought to you by Delete Me. Delete Me makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. Data brokers make a profit off your data. Your data is a commodity. Anyone on the web can buy your private details. This can lead to identity theft, phishing attempts, and harassment. But now you can protect your privacy with Delete Me. What do data brokers do? Your name, contact info, social security number, home address, even information about your family members could all be compiled by data brokers and sold online. The New York Times Wirecutter has named Delete Me their top pick for data removal services. Someone with an active online presence, overly active online presence, privacy is important to me, and that's why you got to use Delete Me to get all that info off the web, and there is a lot of it on there, even if you don't think there is. Got to go look for it, which Delete Me helps you do. If you've ever been a victim of identity theft, harassment, or doxing, and even if you haven't, you probably know someone who has, Delete Me can help. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now at a special discount for our listeners, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/offline and use promo code offline at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/offline and enter code offline at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/offline, code offline. This podcast is sponsored by Brodo. Brodo makes bone broths that are delicious enough to drink. Each cup delivers whole food protein, about 10 grams per serving, along with collagen-building amino acids, electrolytes, and nutrients to help you feel your best, all under 50 calories and with zero sugar or fat. Brodo was launched by award-winning chef Marco Canara. He started selling bone broth out of the side door of his East Village Manhattan restaurant 11 years ago, and now...
Nothing shady about that. Just selling some bones.
It's
out of my...
exactly where you want to get your bone broth. out of the side door of a restaurant.
Hey, where's he getting all
village?
Those bones?
Don't ask. But now, whether you want a quick warm drink or a nourishing base for cooking, Brodo makes it easy. They ship nationwide so you don't have to be in New York City or go to a side door to enjoy Chef Marco's masterpiece. And Brodo comes in 8 delicious flavors, from classic chicken to the spicy nana to more creative blends like ginger, turmeric, herb-infused, or veggie-based broths. Pick up their sampler pack so you can find your favorite. This is delicious.
John's been raving about the bone zone.
Love some bone broth. Nice to have some good protein. It's light in your bone broth, you know? It's delicious. Check it out. Try some of it. Shop the best broth on the planet with Brodo. Head to brodo.com/offline for 20% off your first subscription order and use code offline for an additional $10 off. Once again, that's brodo.com/offline for 20% off your first subscription order and an additional $10 off if you use my promo code offline. In this information environment, I do think that it has become harder to be optimistic.
Yeah.
Because obviously there's like two parts of this. There's the psychological retraining of yourself.
Right.
But we don't exist in a vacuum.
No, we do not.
And we are, I think, very dependent and also easily persuadable by the social context that we exist.
Totally.
And I feel like for the last 10, 20 years now, 10 years for sure, 5 years for sure, we are just constantly bombarded with negative, bad information.
Yes.
Everything that's bad that's going on in the world, which things have been bad in the world and bad things have happened in the world since the beginning of time.
Right, but we were not always exposed to it. And this
every
much.
Second of the
every
day.
Second of the day.
And I do wonder, like how that sort of the obstacles that puts in the way of someone who's trying to become more optimistic.
Big, big obstacles. I mean, like you said it yourself, you hit the nail on the head. Our brains were not like made to experience this much exposure and stimulation to, first of all, just like the sheer amount of whatever it is, good or bad, mm-hmm. like that much information and stimulation and exposure. But it's completely like you said, it's the bad news cycle. And we are living in a 24/7 news cycle. And we know things and we're carrying things and holding things as deeply, you know, feeling humans, like people that we have people that deeply care about their own lives, but also the lives of others that yeah. are just walking around this world. And I think you are one of those people, obviously. And what I think is so scary and not what I want, and a big reason why I think this, I wrote this book and this book is so timely, is because what we talked about before, like what happens to the human when we're exposed to that and we don't have the tools to equip ourselves, is we go numb. Or again, we might be cynical about something. We might be someone that understands that whatever it is we're seeing or reading is not something we like and not something good, and we might have thoughts about it. But we're stuck in this idea of cynicism, which actually comes from overwhelm, which I said before. And there's not a lot of agency that you can move forward and take action with that. And I think
or like you said earlier, or we turn away.
So we look away, we go numb, we look away, we say, you know what? I know the news is bad and it's not making me feel good. And a lot of colleagues like of mine are just like, turn off the news.
Yep.
And I think that's also scary. We need to boundary, but we cannot go through the world with eyes closed. Like we still have to know what is going on
yeah.
in order to make change. So it's not about being ignorance is bliss and deciding to put blinders on and know nothing because all of it is too much and too overwhelming. But at the same time, it's not about we cannot handle all of it like we're handling it now. We need to come up with boundaries and tools to equip ourselves on how. And part of that is regulation tools. I know this like sounds, it's such a buzzword now to talk about self-regulation and nervous system regulation, but the brain doesn't prioritize growth. It prioritizes safety. Mm. And we are all walking around this world, for the most of us, not feeling safe.
Yeah. What are some of those regulation tools?
I mean, everyone has their own unique tools, but for me, breathing tools really help, and one in particular, the 478 breath, which has a lot of science behind it. It helps to regulate the parasympathetic nervous system. And again, this doesn't change the circumstance or what you're worried about. There's also this part of the book that's called the weight of the world syndrome, which a lot of us have right now.
Yeah.
What it does is it gives your body and your brain a sort of reset from the rumination and the negative worry loop that we are now constantly in. You know, ancestrally, I think our ancestors might have gone through fight, flight, freeze mode like once a week when they were like hunting.
Yeah.
There's like research to show we're literally in it
all the time,
all day long. But yeah, breathing techniques are really big for me. I know it sounds, this is just me, but music is a big tool for me, always has been.
Yeah.
And just like moving to it. So like I do something in the morning called wake up and dance. It's the first thing I do to like regulate myself.
That's cool. I mean, that just made me think that, like, I do think that having kids has helped this, like, and having them now at this age,
yeah.
you know, Teddy's 2 and Charlie's 5, and spending time with them. Like, I think when I tell people I was spending time with my kids, because they're the most common question I get, and the most common question, we get from listeners too, is like, how do you stay hopeful? Like, we actually joke about it now because when we ask for listener questions, inevitably 10 of the questions are like, what gives you hope? And then there's people who are just like, I've been following politics for like 10, 15 years and I can't do it anymore. And I'm like, how do you do it? I can't do it. What should I do? And when I say like, oh, I hang out with my kids, I think people take it as, oh, well, you avoid politics now, or you turn away and you hang with it. But like,
no, it's the end.
It's the playing,
right?
You know, and it's the dancing around
right.
with them,
right.
or it's like chasing them around. It's joking about things
yes.
with them, and it's not just taking your mind off it, because my mind
no.
is not taken off of
no.
it. I'm not reading the news, but my mind's still thinking about it.
Right.
But it's like, oh, the movement, the laughter, the oxytocin you get
right.
from just like hugging your children, like
right.
that kind of stuff really does make
actually,
a difference.
It does, and it's actually giving you the tools to equip yourself to be able to keep staying engaged.
Yeah.
That's the part where it's like, this is an and situation. And I don't have to remind my clients or patients. I don't have to remind people to worry. Right? Because we all do. It's part of our human existence. I do actually have a practice where I have people contain their worry. Hmm. They literally schedule worry into their day.
Really?
Into their schedule, into their calendar. Because, and it's like, yes, people are always like, what? You tell people to worry? I'm like, I don't have to tell you to worry. You're going to worry. And anyone that promises you a life without worry is selling you snake oil.
Right.
We're going to worry. It's part of our existence. But like containing it is really, really such an important practice to develop, because just floating worry all day long completely derails your everyday life. And it will. It's what's happening to all of us. It's distracting. We can't make decisions. It paralyzes us from any forward movement, because one worry comes in while we're working on something that we have to get done, or show up as, you know, a colleague or a mother or a friend or whatever, all the roles we play. Another worry comes in the middle of it. We forgot what we were doing, and now we have all these open files in our brain.
A lot of open tabs,
and a lot of this is coming up with tools to stay engaged rather than look away. And I think that's the part that's really important right now, because change is only made when someone actually understands and can imagine that something can change and something better is out there. And I think a lot of people, they can understand being angry about something or just being exhausted and overwhelmed, because it just keeps coming and coming. And the idea of allowing yourself to imagine a possibility that's different seems indulgent and silly.
Some people think it's silly.
But it's survival.
Yeah.
You have to imagine. Your brain does not put forth energy or attention to come up with solutions, whether that's something personal or more global, for you, if it doesn't think that it's a possibility. So we have to train ourselves to live in possibility more, too.
One example of this, just in the political realm that we deal with a lot, is people saying, well, what if we don't have a mid? What if he tries to steal the election? You know, what if he tries to steal the next election? What if he tries to cancel the midterms? What if there's ICE agents by the polls, all that kind of stuff? And I've really thought this through kind of from the perspective of what you've written about, which is like, okay, let's just take it one step at a time here. We don't know.
Right.
It's not like, don't worry, he won't steal the elections.
Right.
Or there'll definitely be elections. I can't tell you that.
Yeah.
I don't know. But how would you act differently right now if you knew that there would be elections or there
not.
Wouldn't be elections?
Right.
Right? Like, what would you do differently? And the question is, what can we do to make sure that what steps can we take to make sure that we do have elections, that we can protect them as best as possible? And then once we do those steps, what else are we going to do?
Right.
Like, we just have to move forward, do all the other work as if we're going to have an election.
Right.
We got to go convince people, persuade people, get people out to vote, all that kind of stuff. Because if worrying about the fact that we may not have an election or that he might try to do something prevents us from doing the work we need to win that election.
Right.
Then that's doubly bad.
It's asking yourself, when you are ruminating over something that is a worry, it's asking yourself not to put away that thought as a possibility, because it might be a possibility. You might be right. It might be a possibility. But what other possibilities exist as well? Mm. Like, it is up to us to ask ourselves that question. Like, this may be the case, and it's not the whole story. We don't know how it unfolds. What other versions of the story could be, to allow ourselves to have that possibility? And at the same time, you know, in visual imagery and science-based visualization, I think a lot of people understand it to, people think it's like just about manifestation and sort of visualizing what you want. But actually what the science shows and what I write about in the book too is we also must visualize the setbacks. We must visualize what we might do when the things don't turn out our way. Like, you visualize a circumstance in all its possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that you're like putting bad juju out there. It's being prepared.
Right.
And it's understanding back to that root of, you know, optimism is not about denying the dark. It's about giving us the tools to see in it when it is dark. Like, optimism is not about knowing with certainty. It's about what you do know is that whatever might come, you'll meet it. And that's based on your own personal historical resiliency. That's where the optimism is cultivated from. You've been through hard things before.
Offline is brought to you by Quince. A thoughtfully built wardrobe comes down to pieces that mix well and last. That's where Quince shines. Premium fabrics, considered design, and everyday essentials that feel effortless to wear and dependable, even as the seasons change. Quince has the everyday essentials I love with quality that lasts. Lightweight cashmere sweaters, short sleeve Mongolian cashmere polos, linen bottoms and shorts, tees and 100% Pima cotton, and European jersey linen. These are the versatile pieces that make a wardrobe actually work season to season. Quince works directly with top factories and cuts out the middlemen. You're not paying for brand markup or fancy retail stores, just quality clothing. Their clothing is rated between 4.5 and 5 stars by thousands of people wearing it every day, and they only partner with factories that meet rigorous standards for craftsmanship and ethical production. You know what? I'm going to give it a 5. I'm going to give it the 5 stars. None of this 4.5 to 5.
It deserves it.
Everything I've gotten from there, I love.
Love Quince.
The light cashmere sweater.
Go check out Quince.
I've loved the polos. I have loved the shorts.
They have so many. They have rugs. They have sheets. It's a good. Go check Quince
before you
buy it somewhere else.
Just go on the website. Check it out. Come on. Right now, go to quince.com/offline for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to build your wardrobe and love it. And you will. Now available in Canada, too. Don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/offline for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/offline. So you have a quiz in the book that helps people understand how optimistic they are.
Yes.
Can you talk about how the questions are connected to optimism and sort of what you've learned from the people who've taken the quiz?
So the quiz actually is adapted or inspired by a sort of more research-based scientific test that Martin Seligman came up with, mm-hmm. who's like the founder of positive psychology. And what always surprised me in that is people that take the quiz that think they're optimistic oftentimes come back less optimistic.
Yeah.
And people that think that they're more pessimistic go in and take the quiz and go, whoa, I'm so much more optimistic than I thought. And I think that's because most people have been defining optimism and their understanding of it in the wrong way.
Mm.
And I think the part that's interesting for me, and I don't want to spoil it too much for anyone that's going to take the quiz, it is in the book, and NPR just put out the quiz today digitally, so if anyone wants to take it and check it out. What is interesting is optimism really lives on a continuum. And I don't believe, after doing this work, that you are either an optimist or a pessimist. You exist on this continuum, and in some circumstances or aspects of life, you are more prone to being optimistic than others. And it's really like about seasons and aspects of life. Like for me, medical health stuff, I am so low in optimism. Like I am really like probably clinically low when it comes to health and like, you know, medical stuff. Whereas, you know, other things and even things that are more macro, I tend to be more optimistic. Or, you know, even smaller things like when you make the wrong turn or you know, setbacks at work-related or whatever those are that are, like, also skill-related. Like, I tend to be more optimistic. This is sort of a spoiler, but a little tidbit. But really interesting to see how people qualify good things that happen to them and bad things that happen to them. Like, are they personalizing which one?
This is what I was going to bring up because I am someone who took it who thinks I've always thought I was incredibly optimistic. I took it and I got a 14, which falls in the 12 to 17 category that says you are naturally quite optimistic, but still take a pessimistic view of the world some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought about it and I went back to the quiz and part of why I think I scored lower on some has less to do with my outlook on the world and more to do with my own self-confidence.
Yes.
Which is an aspect to optimism that I hadn't thought about before. So it's like when you know, did you make everyone laugh because you're really funny or because everyone was having a good time?
Exactly.
I would naturally be like, oh, everyone was having a good time because I'm no comedic genius.
Right, right.
And I would not have thought that has to do
with optimism. And it does. And it's really about the three P's of optimism, if you will. It's like one of the P's is personalization. And so what we find is people that score higher in optimism are more readily able to accept responsibility for like good things that happen personally. Like they had a part in that because of their own skill or, their own actions.
Hmm.
Where a lot of people, and this is where I score low too. And I think it's really interesting. But yes, and then the same people will attribute you know, if you're in a more pessimistic score, you will attribute, like, when something bad happens, you take a lot of personal accountability. Like, this happened because of me.
Yeah.
You know, my team didn't do a good job because, like, I didn't do my part as well as I should have. And the flip is true, too. So someone that's more optimistic might see it as, like, well, you know, maybe we were all having, like, a tough time or a bad day. Or, you know, I worked as hard as I could, but these other, like, circumstances that are outside of me also come into play and have a reason for the impact of the result.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people are surprised by that because when something good happens or a win happens, they're like, oh, it was good luck, or I was at the right place at the right time. Or, yeah, everyone was having a good time, or the opener was really funny.
Yeah.
Or, like, someone told a story before and, like, prepped everyone for a good time, or everyone was drinking.
Yeah.
Whatever that is, instead of saying, like, I tell a great story, or I'm funny.
It's funny because when on the questions about when the bad things happen, I think that's where I'm more optimistic. And yeah. I'm like, I get it. Like, I might have screwed something up, but also
it doesn't mean there's something about my identity.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things. But when a good thing happens, I really feel like weird taking any credit for it.
And that actually makes a lot of sense. And it's where a lot of people, like, that was the big surprising part of this test. With people that kind of generally thought they were optimistic, that is the place in which they sort of the score tipped them a little bit lower.
It is funny because Emily took the quiz. We were talking about this today, and she scored very optimistic.
Uh-huh.
And it now makes sense to me because Emily's much better at being like,
yeah,
I'm good at this, and I'm good at
and
this,
way,
and I'm not as good
very,
at this, and that's okay.
And it's very uncomfortable because our brains tend to, like, really prioritize the things that we're not doing well or that need fixing or that are unfinished.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just how our brains are. And some people are just better at, like, really spotlighting the things they're good at and the skills they have. And it's not, like, arrogance. It's literally confidence.
Yeah, it's confidence.
It's confidence.
Yeah, and that's a key ingredient to optimism.
It is.
I want to sort of end by bringing it back to parenting.
Yep.
How do you think about modeling optimism for your kids when A, you're not always feeling it yourself, and B, the world is the world.
Yep. Well, I love how you said modeling, because I think that in itself is sort of the key there. I think a lot of people think, and myself included, like, we're so pressured into when something happens, like my kid comes home with something that happened to them at school, or like a story or something they read, or not read yet, well, my older one, yes.
Yeah.
You know, or kids were talking about something, or something happened on the playground, whatever it is, whatever struggle they're going through, or something was hard, you know, that they had to do in sports or school. We feel pressured that we have to have this, like, perfectly packaged response for them in that moment of, like, this is how you deal with it. But kids don't learn from that. They learn from modeling.
Mm.
And so if you are someone that is working on your optimism and optimistic outlook, and now you might know something like, oh, confidence is a really big part of increasing optimism.
Yeah.
And, like, one of those aspects is when something goes really well, like, you can't unsee that now that you know that.
Yeah.
And if you are able in the moment, maybe before something went well and in front of your kid, you're just like, someone congratulates you on something, you know, and you're like, yeah, just, you know, it was being at the right place at the right time. You might say something differently now.
Yeah.
And they hear that. They look at it. And so really kids learn from modeling. And I think one of the biggest things that we can do is our language, is really understand what kind of language we're using. Are we using language that is saying, this is permanent? I think that's one of the biggest ones. This is the one, like, I think we can try to tackle one thing at a time. And for me, like, we have so much going on. This permanence piece is what I try to be mindful of for myself. Mm. And while I'm being mindful of it myself, I try to see if my kids are listening. And they are, because now they call me out on stuff and I call them out on stuff. But it's like when you're trying to, the other day, and I wrote about this in the book, it's such a mundane, silly example, but I was trying to open a bottle of pasta sauce.
Mm.
And I was just about to say it. I can never open those things. And I literally said out loud after two tries, like, I can never open these things. I'm never going to be able to open this sauce.
Yeah.
And our kitchen is one of those kitchens that's, like, you know, part of the family room. And Dio, my son, who the one you know both, but Dio looked around because we've had this conversation before. And I think at that age, like 4 years old is when I started, like, that is an age where they start saying language like that a lot. And it's just developmentally appropriate. But because I'm like, I'm trying to work on this, and I like also show them the process of me trying to work on it. Like I just said it, I'm not hiding that from them and going, and he, I hear him go, Mom, don't say you can't. Breathe three times and try for another seven times. He said like seven times and just keep trying. And I was like, oh, and I was like, you're right. I am not able to open this right now. And I'm going to keep trying. And maybe I still won't be able to open it right now, but I'm not going to say I'm never going to be able to open. It's the same way of, you know, when you're driving with them and I don't know, you miss a turn or you're late and it's always at those moments.
Yes.
And you start, it's just like, how are you, or, you know, he's learning to ride a bike, you know, and one of those things, it's like, or when he learned how to tie his shoes, he was so adamant about it because he's the little brother.
Yeah.
And it's just that language of like, I can never. And then they learn that they can, and you remind them of that. And you yourself, however you are going through struggle. And I share that with them a lot. I mean, I think partly because I'm pretty open book. And of course, I have boundaries. They don't need to know all of our struggles. But I'm not a parent that like hides that from them or shoves things underneath a rug. I make many mistakes all day long, and I feel so bad about them a lot of times when they're asleep, of course.
Yes,
I'll look at Alex and be like, should we wake them up? Because like I did this today, I did that today. It wasn't great. But I remember the next morning there's always room for repair. And the repair part, that's the modeling part that is so important for them to see. So if you're working on yourself and you're trying to have an optimistic outlook, or hopefully if you are reading the book and like there's a lot of these little moments that are like, oh, I never thought of it that way. And the whole point of it is like once you see something, you can't unsee it. And so it sort of programs into you. And if you start sort of doing that, or you're even reading a book, like even just having this outside, like my kids have it in their room now. And they're like, we're working on optimism. Like it's, even just that.
Yeah.
Modeling. Like, what are we doing?
The permanence point is so interesting to me, and something I think about when this is a maybe disconnected example, but I think it might not be. We talk, Charlie knows enough about Trump now, right? Because Dad talks about Trump all the time.
Whatever, yeah.
So he finally asked about it. And because, you know, he's watching all these shows now where there's good guys and bad guys, he's like, oh, so Trump is bad. Mm. And then everyone else is good or, you know, and I was like, look, Trump does bad things. Everyone can do bad things and can do good things. And they can be a good person or bad.
Right.
Like, but you're not, because I don't want him to think.
Right.
It's not about Trump.
Right.
Like, I don't care about that. But I don't want him to think that the condition of being bad or a bad guy or a villain or all the shit he sees on television now is a permanent state. Because that means that for him, he's going to think either I am good or I am bad.
Right.
And that, like, I don't have the agency to change and that people don't have the agency to change. And I want him to, and Teddy too, I want them to think that, like, that it is not a permanent condition on whether it's the president, whether it's you, whether it's anyone.
Right.
Like, we're all sort of, we can work on things.
And we're all human.
Yes.
And I think that's part of it, because that, I think that's so important, especially in this age. You know, I see it with my own kids. And one of the places that I feel like really a lot of worry about is like their relationship to perfectionism. Mm. And just like when mistakes are made or when things happen, they immediately are like, identify it as part of them of like, am I bad or am I good? And that's that piece of it. And you're right. Like, I think that's amazing that you're even thinking about it at this age. But this is a really good age to start like understanding nuance and continuum and, you know, what you do and how you behave. And either if it's a mistake or if it's on purpose, all these things, it's not like your cemented identity.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's a good place to leave it. Thank you for coming on. This was a great conversation.
Thank
I'm glad
you.
We got to do this.
Me too.
And the book is The Power of Real Optimism.
Yep.
Deepika Chopra. Thank you so much. Go out and get it.
Go out and get it.
And then I was going to say you'll feel more optimistic, but no, you'll know how to work on yourself and become more optimistic.
Yeah, you'll truly understand what optimism is.
That's right.
And it's a work in progress.
Right. I'll see you at T-Ball tomorrow.
As always, if you have comments, questions, or guest ideas, email us at offline@crooked.com. And if you're as opinionated as we are, please rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. For ad-free episodes of Offline and Pod Save America, exclusive content, and more, go to crooked.com/friends to subscribe on Supercast, Substack, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. If you like watching your podcast, subscribe to the Offline with Jon Favreau YouTube channel. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and the other ones for original content, community events, and more. Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau. It's produced by Emma Illich Frank. Austin Fisher is our senior producer. Adrian Hill is our head of news and politics. Jarek Centeno is our sound editor and engineer. Audio support from Kyle Seglin. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Delon Villanueva and our digital team, who film and share our episodes as videos every week. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.